Ulysses is the book, the great book that nobody reads, because it's hard. It's difficult to get into. The narrative form is constantly shifting. The allusions are huge. I mean, he comments on and alludes to almost all of the English literature that has come before him. And it isn't a story that's about what happened to this character over this amount of time. It doesn't follow a narrative form as we expect it to. So it causes people great difficulty. It's not a book, as I often say, that should be read alone.
This is an interesting chapter for us, I think. And this chapter challenges readers in different ways. I think that it's a bit tricky to see what Joyce is doing with Gertie's narrative voice, that at times is playful and at times maybe we might see as it is making fun
Each
of her.
chapter connects to an episode in Homer's Odyssey. Sometimes it connects fairly directly, sometimes it's much more a looser connection. In Homer's Odyssey, Nausicaa is the young woman who is playing with a ball with her young girlfriends while she's doing the castle laundry and happens to discover Odysseus naked, sea-crusted, exhausted, lying under a bush trying to hide himself, but he needs help. So this chapter looks at the experience of a young woman, Gertie, and her meeting sort of the hero of the book, Leopold Bloom.
She felt the warm flush, a danger signal always with Gertie McDowell, surging and flaming into her cheeks. Till then, they had only exchanged glances of the most casual, but now, under the brim of her new hat, she ventured a look at him, and the face that met her gaze there in the twilight, wan and strangely drawn, seemed to her the saddest she had ever seen.
It's told in the voice of a young woman's kind of magazine periodical. What did James Joyce call it? The mushy, marshy, marmalady, drawersy narrative. So it's kind of syrupy sentimental, but not necessarily in a way to deprecate Gertie's voice, but to use the forms that were available to her in her character to help understand her.
She was trembling in every limb from being bent so far back that he had a full view, high up above her knee, where no one ever, not even on the swing. And she wasn't ashamed. And he wasn't either, to look in that immodest way like that, because he couldn't resist the sight of the wondrous revealment, half offered like those skirt dancers behaving so immodest before gentlemen looking. And he kept on looking, looking.
Bloom masturbates, and he masturbates to a young woman on a beach that he doesn't speak to. And they don't have any verbal exchange, but they have a form of language between them, is what the narrative says.
Then all melted away dewily in the grey air. All was silent. She glanced at him as she bent forward quickly, a pathetic little glance of piteous protest, of shy reproach, under which he coloured like a girl. He was leaning back against the rock behind. Leopold Bloom, for it is he, stands silent, with bowed head before those young, guileless eyes.
What does this do to our idea of Bloom? I mean, he's being positioned as a hero in the previous chapter. He fought off an incredibly xenophobic character who threw a biscuit tin at him. So how can this become part of our image of this heroic man?
And then I think because of the way the chapter is structured and there's this kind of break, and then you realize that she has this disability, then the whole thing is kind of, ooh, you know, thrown into relief almost. And I felt all the more poignant for her, because you realize, you know, her dreams and hopes are all within this context, and her little vanities are within this context, that she's disabled, and that's why she's kind of a little bit apart from the other girls, and she has such a different perspective to the other girls. And then, you know, the way Bloom sees her and how that all transpires. And for me, one of the loveliest, you know, his free association about, you know, women and the relationship between the sexes and, you know, the women's little vanities and competitivenesses and all the insights that he has, and this sort of connection that he has with Gertie, which on the face of it is a little bit maybe weird and gross. I mean, when you think about the central act that, you know, takes place, but is also really, you know, moving and they do have this bond and they meet a need within each other.
Reading it and reading it in a group gets people talking about things that we find really hard to talk about sexuality, about fear, about shame, about xenophobia, about our relationship to history, about our fears, how we call upon our ancestry and how sometimes we have to reject that ancestry, about faith. Ulysses gets us talking about all of those, and Joyce is very careful, I believe, to offer a variety of perspectives. But he is, I mean, ultimately he is a pacifist. That's one of his strong pushes.
I can't but have a personal response to this chapter, because I think hated her response. Because I had all these struggles. You know, I'm a woman pre-women's lib. Mm-hmm. You know, so I remember as a teenager rejecting all this crap.
Yeah.
So to see how she's embracing it and swallowing it, and I admire Joyce's stamina in having to read all the Mills and Boone type sentimental pamphlets and magazines. He must have to absorb that language where he did not repeat himself. In that respect, brilliant. I mean, really brilliant. But the way she doesn't allow her cattiness to come out, although it does slip out in her real reaction to the how annoying she finds the children and the childcare responsibilities and the healthy way the other girls are dealing with the children. All that's great fun. But yeah, I was so angry with her, and that reminded me when I was a teenager of my really sensible, powerful, beautiful friend saying, "Yes, I'll wash your trousers for you," to a perfectly capable young man. And I was like, how can you do that? And I can't forget that. It's really riling me now.